Hi, Patrick Cox here in Boston, and today's podcast has a bit of everything. Call it a linguistic smorgasbord or something. We'll be hitting some of the big themes that repeat listeners expect to hear on this pod. An hors d'oeuvre of free speech, a Chinese main course, improvised, followed by a double dessert of endangered languages. We're eating languages alive? Well, it may keep them from dying.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
Absolute, the biggest load of chicken droppings I've heard in a long time, Jeremy, I have to say.
The World in Words podcast and the World Radio program are co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. The World, the big show, is on more than 280 public radio stations around the United States. You can listen online at theworld.org. Go there to check out all of our other podcasts. I post show notes for The World in Words at theworld.org/language and at patrickcox.wordpress.com. There's also a World in Words group on Facebook, and I'm on Twitter. A shout out this week to a couple of people. First, Dr. Jay Butler, who directs the 2009 Influenza Vaccine Task Force with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. You must be a busy man. Thanks for your kind words. I vow never to use the words swine flu again. Well, never's a big word. Maybe just less than I do now. Part of the problem here is that the word swine is, I don't know what you think, but I find it delightful and funny. Do you remember this from Pulp Fiction?
Want some bacon?
No, man, I don't eat pork.
Are you Jewish?
No, I ain't Jewish. I just don't dig on swine, that's all.
Classic. Second shout out today to the students of an intercultural communication class at Northern Virginia Community College. Thanks for all the posts, and thanks to your professor for the assignment, which was to listen to this podcast. So, coming up, we're going to hear about the role of Twitter in promoting speech, where speech has been enjoined by a judge, then something on a Chinese word that means assembled in a makeshift way. This word has spawned an art exhibit in Beijing. And then a couple of hits on threatened languages, first an interview with a French linguist who's written a book on the subject. And then we take a look at an effort to keep the Lakota language alive, an immersion school that's just opened. And there is a German rock star connection here. This is not a joke. So first, Twitter and free speech. Earlier this month, Twitter trumped the old-fashioned news media yet again. It also trumped a British court. Here's the background. The court in question had placed an injunction on Britain's Guardian newspaper. The Guardian was prohibited from reporting on a particular issue should it be raised in Parliament. And the issue concerned a multinational oil company called Trafigura. Now, Trafigura is accused of dumping waste of various sites in Ivory Coast. Well, that issue was raised in Parliament, and the Guardian didn't report on it. But word did get out, and a lot of that had to do with a human rights campaigner called Richard Wilson. He told the story to The Big Show's Marco Werman.
I was just pottering around at home, and I was sat at my laptop and happened to be looking at Twitter, and I saw this very shocking message from the editor of The Guardian saying that The Guardian had been banned from reporting a parliamentary question, which, to my knowledge, and nothing like that had happened for probably a couple of hundred years. So it was quite a shocking thing. Mm-hmm. So I immediately got Googling and tried to figure out what was this parliamentary question that had they been forbidden from reporting. And it didn't take me very long to find it because they'd given us the name of the law firm, Carter Ruck. And there was only really one question that it could have been once I looked at the website. And it was to do with, ironically, it was to do with Carter Ruck's attempts to suppress freedom of speech around a rather controversial oil company called Trafigura. As soon as I saw that question, I copied the text of the question and published it in a few short tweets on Twitter. And literally within minutes, I saw that hundreds of other people were repeating that message and passing it on. And the gag was on its way to being overturned.
So clear something up for me. I mean, was there kind of no knowledge of this gag order?
There was no knowledge of it until The Guardian reported it. That's one of the scary things. And as it happens,
does that mean there was a gag order on the gag order?
There was a gag order on the gag order. And I don't know how the legal system works in the US, but this is quite an odd phenomenon because actually for all we know, there could be other gag orders on gag orders, and we just wouldn't know about it because the media has been forbidden even to say that some issue or other has been served with an injunction.
And so what ended by happening was while the gag order applied to media, it did not apply to Parliament, and you were then basically reiterating what Parliament had said, which was outside the gag order. Is that right?
Actually, I've checked it out, and I think technically I probably was in contempt of court because the gag order as it had been applied had said you can't report what's being said in Parliament. And I was reporting what had been said in Parliament along with all these thousands of other Twitter users.
So what happens now? Does this make the gag order null and void, or are you going to have to face some legal proceedings because you might be in contempt?
The outrage that came out on Twitter and the way that the information spread gained such a high profile that midway through the following day, the law firm backed down and decided not to contest The Guardian's attempt to get the gag overturned. So thanks to a combination of different factors, arguably Twitter being one of them, we can now talk about that parliamentary question.
Now, you work also part-time for Amnesty International. Is this kind of case, or is this case specifically one that you and Amnesty are working on right now?
I don't represent Amnesty. I work as a fundraiser for Amnesty, and I was really completely doing this in a personal capacity. Amnesty obviously has been involved in the case, and that's one of the reasons that I'm familiar with the details, but I'm not involved in any sort of official thing for Amnesty.
Richard Wilson, a human rights campaigner who started this Twitter uprising in the UK. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
I love the expression that is being used for these kinds of injunctions, you know, that not only stop you from reporting on an issue, but also stop you from saying you're being stopped, as Marco Werman called it, a gag order on the gag order. These injunctions are being called super injunctions. Ain't nothing super about them. So, after all the online chatter about this super injunction, there was some follow-up in the British Parliament. Prime Minister Gordon Brown was asked about how his government would prevent future attempts to keep parliamentary debate out of the newspapers. Here's what he said.
This is an issue where an injunction has been awarded, but it's been awarded in the context where it has to be, remain secret and people are not told what the outcome is generally. The Justice Secretary has talked to the parties concerned. He is looking into this issue, and I hope that on the basis of what he suggests, progress can be made, not just in this case, but more generally, to clear up what is an unfortunate area of the law.
British Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Now, an awkward transition to something totally unrelated. The rapid modernization of China. Cities and lives have been transformed, are being transformed by this modernization, but not always with the closest attention to quality or detail. And there is an art exhibit now in Beijing that explores that fact. It kind of celebrates it as well. We have a report from the Big Show's Beijing correspondent Mary Kay Magstad. And this report also contains this week's eating sideways expression, zuohua. Here goes.
A funny thing's been happening in the gritty northern Beijing neighborhood where artist Chen Xinpeng shares a studio. Humble brick houses have suddenly sprouted second floors and extensions. Some entire new office buildings have gone up. All this in a neighborhood the government intends to knock down for new development in a few weeks. And that's the idea. The government is compensating those who have homes and buildings here based on their square footage. This rush to build is kind of a scam. But Chen salutes the spirit behind those who seize the chance to improve their lot.
How we do things, you know, we can, you know, critique is good or bad now, but actually we achieve certain things by this way of doing things.
But as a taxpayer, there's no little bit of annoyance that someone's throwing up a building a month before it's going to be torn down so they can get money from the government?
That's the point. We're not a taxpayer. I think the big company are the taxpayer in China, like big government-owned company. We artists, I don't know.
So
I don't
kind of look at that and think, good for you, very clever, you found a way of getting something back.
Everybody does that. Yeah. Everybody does that.
Chen says there's a word in Chinese for this kind of approach and this kind of development. It's zuohua. Chen has put together an exhibit exploring its meaning in China today. Artist Michael Zhang, who contributed a piece, says zuohua is hard to define.
It could mean doing things in a makeshift way. Could also mean a casual way of achieving something or cutting corners if it has a kind of a negative connotation. But could also mean being pragmatic when you try to do something. So we are actually taking on both sides of the meanings to do this show. So through pragmatism, we actually achieve a lot of things in China, typically. And also, even though we do achieve a lot of things don't necessarily stand up to scrutiny.
The Tsohua exhibit is a huge inflatable golden tent that moves around in different locations. It's meant to be a temporary transient space, kept aloft by blowers, and Chen does worry about electricity brownouts. There's already been one for a few seconds that caused the tent to sag a bit. Inside are works by Chinese and foreign artists, celebrating the slapdash and ephemeral. There are sculptures made of household appliances, pipe cleaners, and a feather boa. There's one of a skeleton of a cat chasing skeleton mice. Not everyone who comes gets what this is all about. This older woman says, "I don't understand this." When it's explained that this exhibit explores the idea of Tsohua, she smiles and says, "Yeah, actually, China is pretty Tsohua these days." But she adds, "I don't think that's a good thing. I think it's better to do things more slowly and do them right." A young modern dancer named Li Qi agrees.
I think for the government, they'll pay more attention to speed because it'll show what they've achieved. But ordinary people will pay more attention to quality. And having fast development doesn't mean you have good quality. If you don't have good quality, the development isn't very stable because you don't have a sound foundation.
Others here say they're proud of how China's developing. 20-year-old sales clerk Liu Jin says she thinks whatever Tsohua there is in China's development is tolerable.
A system can't be perfect. It's bound to have some flaws. And if the advantages of the system outweigh the disadvantages, I'll still support it because it makes my life easier.
That said, Liu Jin says she doesn't really get how this exhibit is about Tsohua, and in that, she's in good company. Central Academy of Arts professor Xiao Lan sniffs as he comes out from the exhibit, saying good art shouldn't need an explanation for you to be able to understand it, but this exhibit does. The signage in Chinese is pretty Tsohua. Of course, artist Shen Xiaopeng says that's kind of how people have to make their way in figuring out China's development.
We generalize a lot of energies, activities, action, doing things. Actually, these actions raise a lot of new questions, you know, and people will solve these new questions. By solving these new questions, we get more questions, more problems to solve. I think that's the energy.
The energy that's transforming China. For the world, I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Beijing.
And to see more about the exhibit and also how to spell Tsohua in Chinese characters and pinyin, go to theworld.org/language or to patrickcox.wordpress.com. Now, of all of the world's big languages, Chinese is in particularly rude health. Okay, some Chinese speakers are forgetting some written Chinese. We did a report on that, actually, in The World in Words number 14. But all in all, Chinese is a fast-growing language poised to become a dominant, maybe the dominant, global language. So, spare a thought for all of those languages that are moving in the opposite direction, toward extinction. Those are the tongues that Claude Agege is interested in. He's just written a new book called On the Death and Life of Languages. It adds to the recent flurry of titles that make the case that we need to do more to save dying languages. Here he is, speaking with the BBC's Justin Webb.
The number of languages which die every year is 25, and assessing the number of languages on the earth today at approximately 5,000, we can say that within one century, we will have just the half of what we have, which means that 2,500 languages, the half will already have died.
But surely the ones that are dying are the ones that simply aren't being used. So in a sense, there's a kind of natural process there, and actually we will reach, in the end, a number that reflects the number of languages that people actually want to use, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
It's by no means, I'm sorry for contradicting you blatantly, it's by no means a natural process for languages to disappear. The reason why they do is that the tribes, most of the tribes which speak remote and isolated languages, are under the enormous pressure of other languages, to say the truth, mainly English. Also, to some extent, French, to some extent, Spanish and Portuguese. Since these tribes or these small communities which speak these isolated languages are undergo the enormous pressure of widespread languages which are spoken throughout the world. One of the main reasons why these languages die is that this pressure has a killing effect. Unfortunately, some tribes, some small communities give up by themselves, by their own choice, their languages, because they think that these languages have no future and that their children will not acquire a professional qualification by speaking these languages, which are tribal ones.
You make an interesting point as well, though, which is that when you lose a language, it isn't necessarily lost if it's been written down. In other words, you can sort of revivify it. And Hebrew is the example, isn't it, that you give. It is possible then almost to bring a language back to life that isn't in daily use if you've got it written somewhere.
That's quite right. I devote the longest chapter of my book to the revival of Hebrew. And to some extent, it is due to the fact that it was a written language and we had texts in order to revive it. However, I very much believe in what people call an oral tradition, an oral transmission, and languages which are not written are not necessarily for that reason deprived of the possibility of being revived. In Britain, there is a language which is Cornic. It's a Celtic language. It was spoken in Cornwall. And now, on the model of the revival of Hebrew, the Cornish intellectuals, those who want to revive Cornish, have reintroduced Cornish, which, however, was already dead one century and a half ago. It was revived on the model of Hebrew. And what did the Corns, what did the intellectual inhabitants of Cornwall do? They did the same as the Jews. They said, we must introduce Cornish, on a par with English, of course, which is their language today. We must reintroduce Cornish in everyday life in order for it to be a language in which it is possible to say things. And to some extent, they succeeded. Maybe you are informed about that.
Well, I'm not, actually. No, tell us. I mean, that's fascinating. So there are large numbers of people, you think, in Cornwall speaking Cornish to each other?
More and more. More and more. It was almost dead one century and a half ago. But when they saw that Hebrew had been revived after such a long period of death being defined in the terms I have just suggested, they thought, why not us? Why shouldn't we do the same thing for our already long-dead Cornish language? And to some extent, they succeeded.
Well, if there are any speakers out there, the Cornish language, who want to back you up on that, they're welcome to contact us on our website. For the time being, though, Claude Agege, thank you very much.
The BBC's Justin Webb expressing some scepticism about the prevalence of Cornish speakers in Britain today. Actually, we did a little thing about Cornish in The World in Words, number 43, and you can hear much more on dying languages and attempts to revive them in other pod episodes, specifically numbers 4, 23, 30, 42, and 52. Or just listen on right now, because we're taking you to South Dakota next, home to the Lakota language of the Great Sioux Nation. And like so many Native American languages, Lakota is on the verge of extinction. So it's all the more important that the very first Lakota immersion school, with all the classes taught in Lakota, has just been built on the Pine Ridge Reservation. The project got a boost from a German benefactor, Charles Michael Ray of South Dakota Public Radio, filed this story for The Big Show last year.
One of the newest buildings on the Pine Ridge Reservation sits in a cattle pasture in the tiny town of Oglala. The modest structure is the dream of Leonard Littlefinger. He's among a dwindling number of elders who still speak the Lakota language.
Any language where there are not enough speakers, it's going to die. And so we are in a crisis situation. I do agree to that.
To stem this crisis, Littlefinger came up with a plan to build a Lakota language elementary school. But after 10 years of trying, he couldn't raise enough money and was about to give up. Then he met the man who would become the school's main benefactor.
Peter was very instrumental in allowing us to fulfill the vision and the dream.
Peter is German rock star Peter Maffei. He's had 15 number one albums in Germany in the last 30 years. When Maffei heard about the history of Indian boarding schools, he decided to support Littlefinger's dream.
We were completely shocked that in a country like the United States, that young kids were forbidden to speak their own mother language in the open. People who don't speak their own language lose their tradition and religion and philosophy. They cut their own roots.
Maffei's support comes through his CD, Encounters, An Alliance for Children. It features musicians from 14 countries, including Afghanistan, Ukraine, and Sudan. Profits from the CD go to benefit children's programs in those countries. On the last track, you can hear Maffei leading the chorus in a song he wrote titled Children of the World.
One heart, one love, one soul.
Maffei's connection to the children of Pine Ridge is shared by other Germans. Busloads of German tourists visit the reservation every summer, and Germans often volunteer to work on the res. Christina Vormann has been volunteering on Pine Ridge for about 8 years, working to improve health care and housing through her own nonprofit group, the Lakota Village Fund.
There is a very, very deep relationship between German-speaking countries and Native Americans.
She says the German fascination with Native Americans stems from two things. The Wild West shows that toured Germany from the late 1800s to the Second World War, and a series of immensely popular children's books by author Karl May that featured a Native American hero named Winnetou.
In Germany, children were playing cowboy and Indians. All the children wanted to be the Native Americans.
This love of Native American culture brought Vormann to Pine Ridge, and in fact, she helped connect Peter Maffei with Leonard Littlefinger. So far, Maffei's CD has brought in about $150,000 for Littlefinger's school. On the CD, Littlefinger offers a prayer in Lakota.
Grandfather, Creator, we pray for help for children around the world who are sick. Creator, you've given us this language to communicate with you, but we have reached a day when the language is being forgotten. Therefore, we pray for help.
The Lakota Language School on the Pine Ridge Reservation is set to open next fall. Peter Maffei plans to be on hand for the ceremony. He says he might even play a few songs. For the World, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
These dreams are mine. I don't want to work in your diamond mine. I'm afraid of stepping on your landmine. Want you to know that I'm not fine.
The Lakota School is now open. That's very good news. Even better news, this pod won't be making a habit of featuring German pop music. Oh, I made myself promise I wouldn't be snide or snarky, and see what I've gone and said. Okay, it's the thought that counts. No, it's the deed that counts. The school is giving Lakota a fighting chance of survival, and this music is part of the reason why. More on the pod next week. Meantime, post your comments at the World in Words Facebook group page, or at theworld.org/language. Or email me. The address is language@pri.org. Bye-bye now.